So how do we know a good idea is really a good idea for First Nations children and families? Or that that good idea actually works in the diverse and distinct First Nations communities all over this country? Let's dig a little deeper and chat with experts in the field of child well-being about what the evidence says, what are some of the myths, and what works when it comes to supporting First Nations children, young people, and their families. You're listening to Season 2 of Spirit Bearers Ask an Expert podcast. So hello, everyone, and welcome to Spirit Bearers podcast. And today we're going to be talking with the amazing Sarah Clark from Clark Child and Family Law. Sarah has been a part of the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal case representing the Caring Society for over a decade now. And we want to talk to her about the news you've been seeing out there about Canada saying it wants to compensate First Nations victims, and yet they haven't paid a penny. They've been saying this since 2019. So what is Canadian Human Rights Tribunal compensation? And then what's happening with this class action that's on the side? Well, we're going to learn all of that and more from Sarah Clark. Sarah, welcome to Spirit Bear's podcast.
Thanks, Cindy. Thanks so much for having me. Hi, Spirit Bear.
Yeah, Spirit Bear's in there. And actually, Sarah has his nephew, Charlie, with her, as well as Blackberry. Everybody on the legal team, by the way, as a bunch of intel, has a bear. And that's to remind us why we're there, which is for First Nations kids, right?
That's right.
Need to do the job properly. So often this is the part of the case that hits the news, Sarah, and that kind of disappoints me because I think the most important part is ending the discrimination that Canada is doing and making sure it doesn't happen again. That's sometimes called long-term reform, and we talked about that in another episode. But the compensation is important because it's about recognizing that children, young people, and their families were egregiously hurt by Canada in this case. And that Canada owes them a responsibility. In this case, it's a financial responsibility and some support services financial responsibility. But let's begin with the evidence about what were the types of harms that came into evidence at the Canadian Human Rights Act tribunal hearing, which was 72 days long, that led to the tribunal saying, you know what? We have this provision under the Canadian Human Rights Act to award up to $40,000 in human rights compensation for people and choosing to do that for all the victims it identified. So what were some of the harms that the tribunal saw?
So the tribunal talks a lot about the harm of removal, and that's within the context of child and family services. So what the evidence in our case profoundly demonstrated was that Canada's underfunding and discriminatory approach to supporting child and family services actually led to, and sometimes, the forcible removal of children from their homes. That really the way that Canada was funding the delivery of child and family services was driving children into the child welfare system, often unnecessarily. And so what that meant was service providers like child and family service agencies could not actually provide just the basic prevention services to keep children safely in their homes. And that's really how our child welfare legislation works, no matter where you are in the country. That social workers who are working with families to protect children have a legal obligation to provide all kinds of different services to support kids so they can stay home. Research tells us that kids do much better when they live with their families, even when there are some challenges within those homes. And the government knew that and chose to simply fund very, very basic protection services and almost zero prevention services. And so that meant that many, many First Nations children came into care unnecessarily. And the tribunal looked at the harm associated with those removals and the infringement of those children's dignity, that they were not worth the money to receive those prevention programs. So they identified that as a significant harm to children. They also identified the harm that was caused to parents who experienced that removal, particularly for parents who had many children and lost multiple children to the child welfare system unnecessarily. So that was harm that they also looked at. On the Jordan's principle side, you know, there were even some individual cases that were quite shocking that the tribunal reviewed. Cases like children not having access to basic hospital equipment that would support them in their final days in palliative care, or children who require really, I would say, minimal medical equipment like catheters and things like that, where parents were having to wash and expose their children to potential infections by having to wash these kinds of medical equipment because Canada would not fund them. So we saw on the Jordan's Principle side, you know, really heartbreaking stories of children, some of who actually ended up passing away, who were just denied services or products or support simply because they were First Nations children. I mean, my children would never have experienced this level of discrimination. I, as a non-Indigenous person, can really access almost any service I need for my child. And that was not the case on the Jordan's Principle side. So the tribunal looked at those cases and reviewed the evidence and said, not only has there been harm caused to these children, but Canada knew it was doing that. And that's why you see the figure of $40,000. That's made up of two components under the Canadian Human Rights Act. One is for the actual infringement of dignity that results from the discrimination. And the second part is from the willful and reckless nature of the discrimination, which means that we were able to show in the evidence and track through time that Canada knew it was doing that. And that's why you see the figure of 40,000, 20 for the infringement of dignity and 20 for the willful and reckless discrimination.
You know, from what you're telling me, $40,000 for the types of harms you're talking about, that doesn't sound like a lot of money to me. Why is it only $40,000?
So the Canadian Human Rights Act caps human rights compensation at $40,000 per person. So we weren't able to ask for more. And in fact, the tribunal commented in its 2019 decision that if it could award more, it would have. But the Human Rights Tribunal has to provide remedies within the four corners of its own jurisdiction, and it's managed and governed by the Canadian Human Rights Act. So that compensation is at $40,000, and that's the figure that we have. Now, on the class action, as you mentioned, that cap does not exist, and I know we're going to talk about that. But on our side, we were capped at $40,000 per person who was a victim of Canada's discrimination.
Yeah, and this act, by the way, hasn't been updated for decades, right? And that's something that needs to happen for our listeners, is to, you know, get a hold of your elected official and have them update those amounts in the Canadian Human Rights Act, because the types of harms here were just so egregious. Now, you were mentioning that Canada knew these were happening and chose not to do it. That's different than failing for me. Why do you think they didn't do anything about it?
I have asked myself that question time and time again. I don't really have a great answer to that. I think that the ingrained racism within the department is very significant, particularly when the research really started to come out and point to the harm that was being created, which ultimately meant that they chose to do nothing. And I think that this is a line item on the overall government budget, and they treat it like that. They don't treat it as harm to children. However the government operates, they're able to dehumanize these children and these families as not worthy of the respect and dignity that they deserve. And they were able to, you know, I guess, rationalize it to their own selves about how to balance budgets and numbers and who's getting what, when, where, and how, and not look at it from a human rights perspective. I think sort of that racism and that bureaucratic approach together really resulted in their choice to do nothing. I would say what is very frustrating about this case, I've always felt this way, is that it wasn't that the research was showing the problem. That was important to explain how the discrimination was happening. But with almost every report, research, evidence, commentary from the Auditor General about the problem, there was an identified solution. That to me has been so profound as a lawyer in this case, that the solutions were actually identified as early as, you know, Well, I don't even know. We could probably go back in time, but certainly in the NPR report that came out in 2000, there were solutions identified there. In the WANDE reports that came out, there were solutions identified. I think as Canadians have traveled with us through this case, early on, there was a worry about how complicated this all was and that there weren't solutions and how it was too bad that this was happening to kids, but it's complicated and how are we possibly going to fix it? That's never been the issue in this case. Those solutions have been on the books, at least since I've been working on this. And as you know, Cindy, I started working with you in 2002. So there's never been a reason to not do the right thing. They just haven't had the political will to do it.
Yeah, like they were choosing to do this, which is really, that's something that we have to wrestle with. This is after residential schools. It was at the same time in 2008, where Prime Minister Harper got up and apologized on behalf of all Canadians. And yet, underneath the veneer of the apology, they were perpetrating the same type of behavior against this generation of kids. They agreed with the decision that found the discrimination in 2016. They didn't appeal that. But then they started to fight against implementing the order. The tribunal releases this compensation order, the first one in 2019, and a follow-up order after some procedural stuff was dealt with in 2021. When they did that, what was Canada's reaction?
So Canada's reaction, so first of all, even when we asked for compensation in the hearing in 2019, they were 100% resistant. It was quite interesting from a legal perspective. On the one hand, they recognized the discrimination. They acknowledged that to the tribunal in 2019. But then we saw the creep back in of these very, very jurisdictional arguments that again dehumanized the experiences of the children and the families, which was to say, look, Caring Society and AFN, you've brought a systemic complaint. And as a result, you are only entitled to systemic remedies, which means changing the program or funding the structures in different ways, those kinds of remedies. And that because we didn't point to individual children and individual families throughout the evidence, that the tribunal didn't have the jurisdiction to make a monetary award. That was essentially their argument in 2019. And that approach was not supported in law. There are no cases that say such things. And in taking a human rights approach, the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal dismissed that argument and said, no, our job as the tribunal is to not only order remedies that will prevent future discrimination, but we have the ability and the jurisdiction to make orders that will go some way to recognizing the discrimination at the level of each victim. And that's what the tribunal did. They identified the victims and then they ordered that Canada pay compensation to them directly.
I remember listening to those arguments and the inhumanity that you're talking about echoed in the courtroom. And it also was a bunch of hogwash, I think, to most Canadians who are looking at, for example, the terrible murder of George Floyd in the United States at the hands of systemic racism by law enforcement in that country. They appreciated that George Floyd was an individual victim of systemic discrimination. And the government of Canada was, even senior politicians were participating in marches, Black Lives Matter marches, while they're fighting these kids in court. The other thing I found amazing during the case is that during the pandemic, we actually had to argue to ensure that the children who passed away in ways that were linked to Canada's discrimination were also entitled to compensation. Canada did not want to pay the children who passed away linked to their discrimination any money because they said they had not done it in the Indian residential school settlement. This is crazy. And actually, when you think about it, it just doubles up the injustice. The children in unmarked graves, their estates were never compensated by Canada. It's mind-blowing sometimes to see the legal pretzels you have to turn yourself into to make these arguments that they're putting in forward in court to make sense. So the tribunal brings this forward, and then Canada decides they're going to take this to the federal court because they are not happy with the tribunal agreeing with it. And in fact, I saw editorials that I wondered if Canadian officials actually had spurred on kind of saying, well, this is a runaway human rights tribunal. And I hear that narrative a lot. But in order for that to be true, we would have had to see the federal court, when they're called upon, overturning these tribunal decisions. That didn't happen in the case on compensation. Can you tell us about what happened with Canada's appeal and why that federal court decision is so important?
What ultimately happened was the tribunal made a decision in 2019 that gave entitlements to the victims. And then, as you've pointed out already, we had to go back a number of times to sort out various issues, such as ensuring that estates are compensated, putting money in trust for those who would be underage at the time that the money would be paid out, all kinds of different things like that to make sure that we were going to distribute the compensation in a trauma-informed way that really made sure that every victim could be compensated in a way that was going to work for them. So that took some time. And while we worked on that, it's called the compensation framework. You know, we had to wait to hear from the federal court so that when the federal court looked at this case, it had all the pieces of the puzzle together. So ultimately, we went to the federal court and they looked at all the pieces of the puzzle and they said, Justice Favelle said, yes, this is a very reasonable decision. That what the tribunal did in its decisions on compensation was always link the evidence in the case to the discrimination that they were describing. That they always stayed within the four corners of the complaint itself. And that the reason that we all had some sticker shock on the number is not because the tribunal did something egregious by awarding this amount, but because there are so many victims. And I think once Canadians really understand that the number is so big, not because individuals are entitled to such a huge sum under the Canadian Human Rights Act, it's because there are so many victims that when you multiply that by $40,000 each, it gets into the billion-dollar range.
You know, Sarah, on that point, I grew up in a town called Prince George, B.C., and when we think about the number of children, and many people we need to keep in mind, most of the victims here are actually children still. The number of children that Canada hurt is bigger than the population of the city I grew up in and went to high school in. And that's just to kind of give people a kind of a mental picture of how many people were hurt in this egregious action, right? And one of the things that was happening is while that litigation was going on, we had actually the announcement from Kamloops about the children in unmarked graves. And it was only about a week later that Canada was in court, again, not wanting to pay these kids a penny in compensation. It was just really flabbergasting to see the disconnect between their public statements and what they were doing for First Nations kids. So the federal court on September 29, 2021, they released this decision. They say, Canada, you are wrong. You've got to pay these victims. But Canada's still not happy. So they go to the next level up, which is the Federal Court of Appeal. And just for listeners, that's one level below the Supreme Court of Canada, right? That's where this thing is at. But then they come out and they announce, hey, we've got a different pathway. We're going to pay this compensation. But we actually want to give people more money than the $40,000. So we're going to settle this part of a class action that's been lodged against us. Now, this is where things get a bit complicated, right? People know about the Indian Residential School class action. But it seems to me like people are already getting $40,000. So these other folks, if they're going to try to build on these orders, they got to make life better for all these victims. They're kind of almost given a gift, these class action folks, about, you know, here's a legal award, make life better and maybe include some more people. So can you explain a little bit about what that looks like?
Sure. So there are actually three different class actions that were commenced sort of starting in 2019, I believe, although don't quote me on that year. I always get these guys mixed up. But there are three separate class actions that were ultimately joined together, and they generally do track along the chronology and legal issues that we raise in the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal case. But they're brought in civil court, which can give more damages than what we have access to under the Canadian Human Rights Act.
Yeah, and that's a good thing.
And it is a good thing. What ended up happening with the class action is the three class actions were joined together and they were certified by the federal court, meaning that the federal court agrees that the facts of the case have a commonality as between all of the victims. And so if, instead of each individual victim having to litigate against the government of Canada as a result of its own negligence, they can join together in one piece of litigation. And that's also a good thing. And so the class action folks worked together with Canada to build a final settlement agreement that, as you've stated, was stated publicly, that Canada wanted to compensate its victims through the class action process and ensure that victims would receive their $40,000, and for some children and adults, maybe more, depending on what happened in their lives over the course of their involvement with Canada's discrimination. And so that was the starting point for the final settlement agreement. And eventually they did sign a final settlement agreement last summer and attempted to bring that to the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal for approval.
Yeah, not approval, just our listeners. You might remember the headline, $20 billion, we're finally going to pay these victims. And Sarah's right. I mean, the word they wanted was to see if the tribunal would approve their order. But really what they were trying to do is get their final settlement to replace the tribunal's orders, right? And that would have been an okay thing if the promise that Canada made was delivered, is everybody gets their 40 and maybe even does a little better than that. But that's actually not what was happening for everyone. Can you explain why this $20 billion in compensation was a problem? What would it have done for some of the victims?
The problem was that the class action settlement did not actually track all of the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal victims. And what I mean by that is the parties to the final settlement agreement, consciously or unconsciously, I'm not going to cast aspersions on intention, but the result is what matters when you're a kid, is that the final settlement agreement cut out some victims. Most importantly, I would say some child victims. So what the tribunal did when it made its compensation award in 2019, I'll just give an example. It said that all children who were removed from their home, family, and communities were victims of Canada's discrimination and are entitled to compensation. And from our perspective, that meant that if Child and Family Services made an active decision in the life of the family that resulted in the child having to leave the home because they could not provide prevention services, that that child is entitled to compensation. And we were very careful in our approach with the tribunal to make sure that we didn't distinguish between children who were placed in a foster home and children who were placed with maybe a family friend in an urban center or something like that. Because the result was that you had to leave your home, family, and community because of children's services being involved who did not have the ability to keep you there safely. That was what the discrimination was about. Because at the level of the child, whether or not you're going to live with a stranger who your parents might know or living in a foster home, I mean, the experience is not really that different. It's about having to leave at first instance. And unfortunately, in the final settlement agreement, the parties to that agreement decided that they would not compensate children who were placed with a family friend, for example. So what they, we're getting into technical land here, Cindy, yeah. But really what the final settlement agreement did is it said, we will compensate children placed in care funded by Indigenous Services Canada. So that would be a foster home or a group home or something like that. And will not compensate children who were placed in non-Indigenous Services Canada funded care. So a voluntary placement, for example, or something like that. They were not going to compensate those children.
And one thing for the listeners to know, too, is that's actually the most common type of placement. I mean, social workers are out there trying to do their best, keeping children within a circle known to them and their families. So these informal placements, they're the most frequent. They're actually more often than being put in, quote, foster care. So, you know, disentitling, which means you're already entitled to the $40,000, right, Sarah, as a child in care?
Yes.
And then if the tribunal would have approved this final settlement agreement, you would have actually not received any money in this particular case. And then there were other classes of victims who may have seen the amount go from $40,000 down to $20,000. $1,000, and still more who are kind of uncertain in the Jordan's Principle land about who would get what, right?
That's right. And on Jordan's Principle, you know, that was why we argued to the tribunal that we had concerns about the approach One of the things that was frustrating in the life of this case was having to argue with Canada about what essential services means, what those two words together means, what delay means, what denial means. You know, we had to go back to the tribunal and get direction from them about what these common phrases mean at the level of a child. And because the class action final settlement agreement used a different approach, we couldn't tell whether or not it would capture all of the children that the tribunal intended to capture in its orders. And so that was another argument that we raised with the tribunal, was to say, look, it may be fine, but it also may not be fine. And so we did caution the tribunal around approving the final settlement agreement without more information. And the tribunal agreed with us on that. They wanted to make sure that children who were harmed by the delay or the denial of Canada's improper interpretation of Jordan's principle would not be cut out. And that was another reason the tribunal would not approve the final settlement agreement.
Yeah, and the number of that order is 2022 CHRT 41 for legal beagles who want to look it up. Or we have some user-friendly information sheets for everybody else on our website, fnwitness.ca. The other thing I want to do is shout out for Aboriginal People's Television Network, who live streamed the case and also live streamed the whole case, the 72 days of hearing. So shout out to APTN for bringing that to folks across the country. So the tribunal says, no, hold on a minute. There's lots of good things about your final settlement agreement, but we can't take away money from people we've already awarded it to in recognition of the harm that Canada causes them. And within getting that ruling, Canada launches another appeal, don't they? So we still have that one at the Federal Court of Appeal. Now they're double barreling these kids after saying they're not fighting First Nations kids in court. They are fighting First Nations kids in court still.
We have endless litigation happening right now. We're still at the tribunal. We're at the Federal Court of Appeal, and now we're back at the federal court.
It's crazy.
And it's actually a challenge to explain in user-friendly language, what is really going on here? So on the one hand, you have Canada's appeal, the Federal Court of Appeals saying, don't pay anybody. And then at the federal court, Canada saying the tribunal should approve the settlement. So it is a strange turn of events. It's hard to comprehend or follow what is going on. And now we are back in every jurisdiction we could possibly be in this case right now. So it's going to be a busy year.
And for victims, the bottom line is the same. Canada promised to pay and hasn't done it, despite three legal orders now requiring it to pay. Now, First Nations leadership in December passed two very helpful resolutions, giving direction on ending the discrimination and stopping it from happening again, but also on compensation. And really what they said is, yeah, Canada, you need to pay this Canadian Human Rights Tribunal money, like pay it, and plus the interest in the supports, and also make sure that you're doing more than that, as the government of Canada had promised to the victims through the class action. So there's some discussions coming up. What could happen in the months ahead for victims? If Canada got enough pressure, it could pay that compensation overnight, really, to these victims. Do, as the tribunal said, put it in at least interest-bearing so these victims get some interest off their money instead of Canada getting interest off it. What are some of the things that we can expect in the coming weeks and months on this?
Well, I think it's hard to speculate what could happen. I mean, as was shared with the federal courts, the parties are getting together in February to talk about whether or not a settlement is possible. So a settlement is possible. And of course, if a settlement doesn't go forward, then we're back in court. And whether or not that means we litigate on both fronts at the federal court and the Federal Court of Appeal at the same time, or the parties structure some kind of a process to deal with each of these cases on their merits at different times, it's hard to say right now. I think that the takeaway is that you're right. Canada could pay what's already been ordered and deal with the rest after. I think that's what's really important that Canadians understand, is that there's nothing legally stopping Canada from paying the money, mm-hmm. other than its own view that it doesn't have to. And that is a problem.
And that's a further injustice to these victims, right? I mean, you're a victim. You've already been hurt by them. You're a child in most of these cases. And then you have the government trying to play games with actually trying to not pay you that compensation that it already legally owes you.
You know, Cindy, I have a lot of hope. I have to say, I think that the tribunal's decision in CHRT 41 sets a path forward.
It does.
And it's a long decision for those who might want to read it.
170 pages.
It's long. It's not for the faint of heart. It's not something you can whip through in 30 minutes or less. But, you know, I am very optimistic that the tribunal really took the time to understand both legally and at the human level what is going on in this case, what the goals of all of the parties are, and really that if we are really trying to acknowledge the discrimination at the level of the child and of the victims, then there is a path forward. So, you know, I would really urge people listening to this to read the decision. And if you don't read the decision, to at least read the letter decision. There's a shorter decision that the tribunal released in October of 2022 that kind of sets the framework for its longer written decision. And there's great stuff in there about how the parties can work together, ideas about how to fix the problems that the tribunal identified. And there is a way forward. And that's where I think the pressure really needs to come. Canada, pay the money and do what the tribunal is telling you to do. As I said earlier, you know, this isn't a case where there are no solutions and we're all wandering around scratching our heads how to fix the problem. That's not this case. We have the solutions and the tribunal has set a framework for us to follow and we can do it. I know that I have the sunny optimism and I'd like to share that sunny optimism. I think there is a path forward if we listen to the tribunal.
And the federal government's results in, even though it keeps on bringing all these appeals, it keeps on losing in court. And that's what listeners need to remember. There's been over 30 decisions in this case, not only by the tribunal, the federal court and federal court of appeal. Canada's lost all of those except for one that was overturned on appeal. So really, its track record in court is terrible. I walked here and I passed the Department of Justice. And I am really hoping that at these upcoming talks, they really embrace what that means. Because so far, throughout Canada's history, that's been the Department of Injustice. Better is possible if they simply choose to do the right thing. Sarah Clark, we're out of time this time, but we'll be back and talking about compensation and sharing with our listeners what actually comes out of these talks, if anything. And if not, we're going back to court. And I feel confident that Spirit Bear and the kids are going to win again, because it really is about just putting the truth before the decision makers in these various levels of court. And they all can see clearly what Canada is still grappling with, which is that these kids matter and justice has to be done because the facts require it. Thank you very much for joining us, Sarah.
Thanks so much, Cindy.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Spirit Bear's Ask an Expert podcast. Be sure to tune in for more episodes coming up where we'll do this all again and find out what works for kids. And of course, you can find us on Twitter at Caring Society or visit our website, fncaringsociety.com, where you can get all kinds of information about this topic and our future episodes.